Good afternoon, everybody. When asked to talk about the spiritual needs of young people, I find myself, this is I work at Duquesne University, which was founded and is run by our community, the Priests and Brothers of the Holy Spirit, founded in 1878 as a Roman Catholic institution. And I've also worked at the University of Houston and Texas Southern University, working in Newman Centers, which would have been sponsored by the local archdiocese in Texas, in Houston. Being on Duquesne's campus, the demographics mirror Western Pennsylvania. So I run into students of all religious confessions, and students who are unabashedly atheist or agnostic, but very generous and very good. And as I was reflecting on where I am now, at Duquesne, we have the opportunity, being a Catholic school, to challenge the young people. And one of the things that they receive as they come to Duquesne is a little card, and it has expectations of a Duquesne student. Regardless of who they are, whether Christian, agnostic, atheist, Muslim, Buddhist, these are expectations that we ask students to live up to. And happily they do. You know, and I think that they like to be appropriately challenged. I've also, you know, for quite a number of years, I've been working with young men who are studying to be either priests or brothers. And once again, if you create the environment and appropriately challenge, young people, I think, appreciate that. They also appreciate authenticity. But there's a wide spectrum of the way that they approach and appropriate faith, the way they live it, the way they share it. And working in now in campus ministry, you know, our congregations will turn over every 4 years. And we may have contact with students for maybe 2 years, and then they're going to go off to live in an apartment and get engaged, if at all, in a local parish. And to me, young people are mystery. You know, I don't know exactly where they come from. I don't know what they will become after they leave. But they stand before us and they come and ask to be engaged and participate. And I think that it's incumbent on us to create an atmosphere where they feel that they can be themselves. At Duquesne, we have every Sunday night students from St. Vincent de Paul, which is one of the ministries, and it's open to everybody, come and they feed the homeless. They go to the dorms and get food from the cafeteria, make small portions, and then go out and carry toiletry items, clothing, hats, coats, whatever they can gather. And it could be up to 30 kids every Sunday night. And although they call it St. Vincent de Paul, which is a very Catholic organization, it's open to anyone. And we have had atheist students who are part of the leadership. You know, and there is something about service that students resonate with. Regardless or in spite of the religious dimension, you know, I think that there is a common language. It's just maybe not universally adhered to, or they may take that there is an obligation to serve, but maybe not an obligation to confess or practice a particular faith. In campus ministry, because of the, you know, we are receiving students from many different religious backgrounds. You know, it's up to us, I hope, to create an atmosphere where students can come and be themselves, be welcomed, and hopefully appropriately challenged. And since we have some other members of the panel, I think I'll pass the microphone, and maybe later we could have questions.
Hopefully that stays. Very good. Yeah, he's already hit on one of the things that I had pondered about, and it is a bit of a buzzword, the notion of authenticity, right? Young adults, and if we are talking about college students, we want to talk about college ministries, campus ministries, etc. That's all good, but that really, if we talk about that, we're talking about young adults, and there is, I say this often, our young adults, this millennial generation, has been sort of studied sociologically more than just about anybody else at that age. Authenticity is really important. They have a very well-defined BS meter. They know in a heartbeat if they're someone's trying to buy something or sell them something, or it's part. I mean, this is the digital native people. And they know that if there is not a cost to something, to the product that they're at, they are the product. They know that there's a whole notion of people trying to get them or bring them in. And it becomes, I mean, it extends everywhere. And they're very cautious. They want to know if you're real and if you're going to see them as human beings. And it's hard sometimes. When you start to have conversations with folks, even with among the core students that are at who gather at my center, who are part of our sort of campus community, I go through some exercises about this is how you have a conversation with people, right? Because that's not a skill that they necessarily have. So here's how you have a conversation with people, and you're going to talk about where you come from or what your hobbies are or what events you like to do or your acquaintances or travel, right? So it's a little acronym we call WEET, and it helps people sort of, all right, so this is how you have small talk with someone. And so, and then one of the people goes, well, how do you get from there to the religious conversation? You don't. The conversation, the small talk, isn't an ends to a mean or means to an end. It's to create the relationship that is there and to be real and to be open and to be vulnerable with folks. And that's really an important part of that. Because then folks will trust you. And you might find things going deeper and that other stuff coming up naturally. I think with my intro mentioned Church of the Geek, a podcast I have with actually a pastor down there, Houston, too. He and I have a conversation. One of the things we talked about recently was the notion of reboots. So reboots are, before it was like if your computer was on for a really, really, really long time, it accumulated a bunch of sort of unoperable processes or stuff in its memory and in its stuff. And every once you have to sort of turn it off or reboot it to get all that stuff cleared out and the computer is going to operate better. Same thing happens now when we have movies or comic books or things that, stories that have been around for a long time, they'll reboot and we'll see them again. Where the core stuff is held onto, but some of the details have been let go. We see it a lot with superhero movies, and that's sort of where it comes out. But I think in a lot of ways, young adults are in that process of rebooting issues of faith and stuff. Because for a long time, out of our history, we've dealt with issues around belief and doctrine, and I think they're very important. But very often we'll start with, well, what do you believe? Young adults, they want to capture more, I think, the sense of practices. We think, from a modern mindset, if we get our mind around it, our actions will follow. I think in the new sort of rebooted, it's more of a return to ancient thought. If we get our body doing it, do those practices, and things that used to happen, our minds will follow. And I think that's where there's a connection there to the service, that's part of it. It's easier for them to make sense of an experiential event in serving or in praying or in worshiping that is something different. And there's that sense then of something beyond themselves that is important. So...
I have a big enough mouth. I'm not sure I need one of these. At least that's what my sweetheart tells me. You can hear me back there. First of all, I want to publicly thank my colleagues. You've got to love college students and love the academy deeply to do college ministry. And I want to speak for a few minutes just from where I come from. I did do some campus ministry at Allegheny College with athletes, but I came into college ministry after quite a long stint in traditional pastoral ministries. And that's because of the direction that God took my heart personally and some of the things I had seen and experienced. So there's two particular areas that I want to talk about. My passion is the intersection of faith with education, learning, and work. And one of the things that deeply concerned me as I talked to college students, I do believe this ties in, you know, the topic of this is, you know, I kind of renamed it the spiritual care and feeding, if you will, of college students. One of my deepest concerns is I would begin getting, you know, earning the right to hear about the life, the story of a college student that I was sitting across the lunch table with. You know, I always wanted to hear their story, where they came from. But I always wanted to ask them the question, why are you here? Because there is an assumption. Listen, I'm an education guy, so I'm not knocking education in any way. I love education and learning. But I believe a student needs to know why they're there. And a lot of the answers that I heard, from my perspective and where I come from in faith and so forth, really kind of broke my heart. The answer usually was, I need to get a good paycheck. So learning is about credentialing. I need this degree in order to get a good job, in order to, you know, and now that it's interesting, now that I'm working mostly with graduating seniors and first year out students, I'm finding they're perceptive. They're finding out that that's a myth because they're not finding jobs in their field. And so they're wrestling with those kind of things vocationally, which is a real spiritual issue. What, in other words, what is God calling me to do? What is God asking me to do? What's my place in this, you know, what's my task, what's my work in this area, in this time that God has brought me into this world? So that was one of the answers that kind of broke my heart was, I'm here because I don't believe that earning a paycheck is the totality of human flourishing. And I don't think they believe it is either. Heard service mentioned a couple of times. So I think this is a deep concern for them, and I think it should be for us as churches, as faith-based organizations. I think it should be for us as we try to serve them well. The second question I would ask them is, what are you studying? And they would tell me, and we would engage in that a little bit. And a third question I would ask them, do you like what you're studying? And often the answer was no. Anybody worked in a job that they absolutely did not like? Could you imagine, you know, and I think about the people that do that over a lifetime. Listen, work, we understand because of the fall, it's toil. But if we truly believe as you know, in my case, you know, as a Christian, that God has something for us on this earth, then I believe that's what we should be digging into. And students were very receptive to that. So that's why I spend so much time, especially with graduating seniors in my role of director of recruiting, talking to them about what their next steps are. And if it's to come work for us, fantastic. We invite them into that process. But if I discover that they really love counseling, that they really love engineering, that they really love some of these majors that are way over my head, I encourage them, go do that and do it well. And so I think they're seeking. Tying into what my brothers here said, they're not seeking a job. They're seeking meaningful employment where they can invest the talents and gifts and mind that they've been given into something. And so working with them on that level. That also ties in a way. It seems like two separate things. But it also ties into something else that deeply concerns me. And that is, and once again, I'm talking about Christian college students. That depending on what study you look at, Barna's study says that 60% of Christian college students will walk away from the church by the time they graduate. And so giving them, as we had talked about over here, that authentic space where they have the opportunity to seek and to wrestle with the various worldviews that they're receiving, that they're hearing about and learning about on the college campus, and to be able to discuss that in a authentic, safe place is vital. And I think that, and I'm speaking as a former pastor here, so grace is appreciated. One of the things that I noticed in the churches that I've been a part of over the years, and this may not be yours, but at least in my circles, is that we know what to do with them as a church until they hit 18. Now we're not quite sure. And there's been this assumption that they just go away, they go to college, they do what they do for 4 years, and at some point they'll come back. That's not necessarily the case, is what we found. Some of them do, that's true. But one of my deep passions and concerns is not only what they're doing, what education means and should mean to them, but keeping them tied into a local faith community while they're in college. I used to have students say to me, well, our FCA huddle, that's my church. Well, no, because the church is intergenerational. You need to be involved. And so one of the things that I've worked towards is helping to connect the two. And so that a church can help them with their vocational issues. If you can do mentoring programs and things of that nature within, a faith community, connecting college students to, for instance, one of the students that I work with now is an accounting major planning on heading into the business world, and he is connected with a mentor within the church, who's also a business person. And so we work to make those kind of connections. So those are my two top concerns. Why are you doing what you're doing? Does it make sense to you? If it's for money alone, that's not good enough. That doesn't lead to human flourishing. It's important. I like to have it. I don't know about you. It helps. But it's not the totality of human flourishing. And then second, a tie into a faith-based community that is truly caring and loving and willing to invest in the next generation.
Sometime back, I remember reading a study about particularly this present generation, many of them, somewhere around 60, 65, 70% had no real church background to begin with. I mean, that they were coming to colleges, and even when they showed up at maybe a church in the college community, they really didn't bring any background with them. I mean, they were ignorant of even some of the basic foundations of what we would consider the foundations of the faith across the church spectrum. Is that?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So I can't even assume that some of our foundational sort of like biblical stories are understood. So just it was in the session of human trafficking earlier today, right? And you mentioned about the prodigal daughter, right? And I went,
yes.
If I were to throw that out there, I'd be like, okay, so here's the story. That is, the second son goes out, and I'd have to recap the entire story. A large number of college students might have, just the ever so barest connection with enough of it that they might even identify themselves as Christian. Like, yeah, I'm Christian, because my family went, and we didn't go to church all the time, but they still had some sort of affinity there, right? But a good third of them right now are what we call completely unaffiliated. They don't have any connection, and
so they wouldn't relate. What does he mean by that? The prodigal.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So have to turn around and
biblical. Yeah.
Those foundational stories that are incredibly ingrained within the culture. I mean, they're everywhere, You know, or they might use a phrase that has a connection to Scripture that we use all the time in our language, right? I'm trying to think of something else that would, but they can't see it. They don't understand. Or they might talk about being a good Samaritan, but they have no connection. Like, why we use that language, and what does that mean? And so those are important. So there's ways to, you know, we can't assume anything. You know, I did have my student who was actively involved in my congregation, in my campus ministry, and you know, I threw out a biblical reference, and he's like, no, don't know it. Okay, so all right, let's talk about that, and he was in awe, and like wow, that's a great story. I'm like, yeah, it really is. So those are challenges for us, but at the same time, right? That means we get a chance to tell the story again and help them discover that story. And so then they come at it with some new eyes, right? They're not carrying a lot of the baggage that we, like, okay, oh, here's the story again. Like, we're in church, right? And we're like, okay, it's a story. And we turn our ears off. We stop listening. But here's a great chance for them to hear it again. And then I get to hear how they hear it, which could be very different. And they might have some really brilliant ways to think about that. So
applications. And,
yeah.
That's a fantastic thought. I just want to share with you, I was doing some research and part of in the denomination that I pastored in some years ago. During that time, I was doing some research and I was tying it into our denominationally sponsored universities. And one of the, it wasn't that long ago, we're talking 6-7 years ago, but one of the professors who I was interviewing, one statement that stuck out to me was about the biblical illiteracy, even coming out of our churches, that he said to me, Cliff, if there was one thing that I could ask our churches to do is to teach the Bible again to us. You know, because they're coming into ministry to prepare for ministry, and they're still the biblical illiterate. He put that on the church. I don't know where, you know, I'm not saying that as an indictment against the church. I'm just saying that's a statement that he made, but that's an interesting thing that you bring up about new, fresh eyes.
Another question.
I'd like to hear first one or two things that you think churches can do to help you all in what you're doing. You don't see them all the time. You don't see everybody. The churches don't either. Churches aren't even if they are a local college. But what do you think churches do better? I think for you.
Good question. The one thing that we try to do is allow students to take leadership. You know, and many times when they come home, that's an area that is rather closed. You know, we're trying to develop the next generation of leaders. And even within staff, you know, oh, they missed that. And I will say, I don't care. Let them make mistakes. Let them make a lot of mistakes. You know, it's not, we've done this. It's part of what we do. That as they pick these things up and begin to experiment, let them make a mistake. But we're trying to develop leadership. And as they come forward, they're listening. You know, they will capture what it is that we want them. You know, if they're serving at Mass, if they're going to lead one of the groups that we're preparing, you know, we call them to service. Well, we need young people to be kind of group leaders. So, you know, as they come back, to engage them, not as the little person who went off to college, but maybe as a young adult who's developing, but still not done.
I think you could even invite them back to do that if they haven't.
And when they, you know, when they come to us, you know, come back after a weekend, oh, I was asked to do this or to help here. You know, it really affirms that they're seen as people with gifts.
My answer is going to be similar. Start young. I mean, include them in the life of the church from the moment they're born. There was a recent, a new article put out every "Why Millennials Aren't in Your Church" kind of article out there every week. Just it happens. But one of them, which really resonated with me, probably because it was not my experience, but I know friends who have experienced it. You know, and this is not, I'm not trying to make blanket condemnations, but I think we really need to hear this. You know, when I was little, you sent me to nursery, and then when I was a little bit older, you sent me to children's church, and then when a little bit older, you shuttled me off to youth group, and then in this, you shuttled me off there. It was always sort of this isolated existence that the youth had, and they were not welcomed in. You know, if you build it in from the beginning, get them practicing it, and have it become a habit, and I'm all for routine. You know, because there are some very strong connections that can be formed over that again and again. The other thing that I know that helped with me in the process of all of this, I always had a safe space to ask questions. There was nothing that was off limits. I could ask anything, and I continue to let my students know that. You have a question, I don't care how irreverent you think it might be, ask it. Because you're not going to be the only one who asks it or has that notion, and we can take it. We can do that. So those would be the things. Safe space for questions, and start them really young. You start them really young, makes my job a lot easier.
I guess the only thing that I can add to that is that you're in proximity to the church, to a local campus. Let your local campus ministers know that you're there and you are open, and ask them for suggestions how they could be incorporated into the life of the church. You know, open a dialogue with them. And, you know, for instance, there is a church I know in the South Hills that has, food. I told my daughter I was going to be part of a panel talking about, you know, the care and feeding of college students. She said, food, yes, food. My daughter's 17, food. They'll drive literally 20, 25 minutes downtown to pick up, you know, several congregational members to pick up students and bring them. So I think it's good to have a dialogue with local campus. Everyone's with campus access, you know, which is always an issue, so we can't just go waltzing onto the campus. But they're the ones that can, we can really have a dialogue and collaborate with to understand, you know, how we can, as local churches, minister to the campuses that are in proximity. So that'd be something like that. Great question.
Now, I would imagine students that maybe come to faith in college were never involved in a local church.
That's right.
They're starting square one. The expectations of church, you know, as a pastor, I want to know people who minister among us. And we can take risks. So it's a climate of risk-taking, allowing people to make mistakes, which, you know, Cliff, you're here in our church, micromanaging from the top down, and there aren't a lot of risk being allowed to be taken. You know, someone's just trying to, you know, control everything from the top. There's no space for that sort of thing. But young college people coming to faith in college, getting integrated into the church, just being welcomed and feeling welcomed, I assume, is kind of where they are at, not necessarily looking to be involved in leadership per se, but anyway, that's just my little two cents. I'm going to need to depart. Tom is part of our planning committee. Make sure that everyone fills out their evaluation forms, and you guys can close. Thank you so much for being here, everyone. You guys continue. I'll see you in the meeting, okay, Tom? Yeah.
Thank you very much. I could talk about this all day, so I'm going to pull out my clock here. So I'll keep you until dinner time.
So, I mean, this is a time I feel that I am in direct contact with college students, I'm on campuses all the time, and in our center, and our center is right on Forbes Avenue, right in Oakland, right in between Pitt and CMU's campuses. And this is the time they're asking the questions of meaning and identity. Who am I? What am I doing, right? And sometimes their answers to the what am I doing, are, like Cliff says, are not well developed. That, you know, they're doing it because everybody keeps asking, what are you going to do? And, well, I'm going to go do this because, well, it seems all right. Probably going to have a good job out of it. You know, and those are the ones who usually by the second year are going, yeah, I'm not doing that anymore. I don't know what I'm doing. And then they have the crisis. And so to talk about issues of vocation, to what are we called? And to hear that. And sometimes to say what we're called to and what we do to get a paycheck might be two very different things. You know, sometimes we have a job just so then we can carry out the thing that we're called to. You know, right? And so those meaning and identity, those are deep, deep questions. And I'll say this too. Those are sort of primary theological questions. And there's a lot of sort of conventionalism out there that says millennials, young adults, don't like theology. Actually, I think they love theology. They don't like theology when it's used as a club to make sure you fit in the right box. Squish them in there and beat you over the head with it. They do like theology when it helps them understand who they are, what they're called to, the God who loves them. That becomes really important.
Much more involved in service than I ever was, and than my friends ever were. They're much more committed to their faith, whether it's their religion, whether they haven't necessarily followed the religion the way they've been following the faith, which I don't have a problem with. But their kids that they run with, and the people that they're involved with, and the activities and all the things that are physically on campus for them are a lot more prevalent, a lot more involved in service than whatever that I was. Is that what you're finding as well? And why are those numbers so high?
Yeah, I mean, and I'll let these guys chime in because I don't know the totality. You know, they're right on campus, so if they can share their experiences. But I do know it's one of the reasons, personally, why I wanted to get involved as a, you know, disgruntled, disillusioned Gen Xer, and with millennials in particular, as that generation. Is because, you know, there's a lot of myths that go along. As my brother, you know, they have been so studied and we think we have them big. What I found was very different. They breathe life into organizations because they don't just want a job. They want to serve. Most of them are willing to take a year or 2 years, to take a gap year to go serve. One of the students that I'm mentoring right now, you know, I'm encouraging him. His degree is in organizational leadership, something of that nature. I mean, he's so focused on serving and doing service trips that he's forgetting about his academics are kind of taking a back seat. And I'm telling him, you know, what God's calling you, I understand you love this, but you've got to maintain academic faithfulness here in order long term to be able to sustain what you love, what you want to do. So I agree. I think a lot of what we've heard are myths. And I'll be glad to let these guys speak more to it, but it hasn't been largely my experience either. I think if you believe in generational theory, which is relatively new, you know, the generational theorists are saying that this would be the next great generation, like the GI generation. They're the ones that's going to do a lot of because. According to generational theory, generation cycle, and so the next cycle, which would be the millennials, will be the ones that'll take the bull by the horn and right a lot of the wrongs of previous. So, you know, I do see things differently.
I don't, you know, I know that there are these statistics out there. I just don't know the faces that go with them. You know, the number of students who are not engaged in practice of the faith, you know, there are some who, you know, they will express that they're atheist, agnostic, they have no time for religion, but they're delightful people too. You know, they come and they get involved. They may not have the confession, but they have the desire to serve. At Duquesne, we require service. You know, if you join a group, the group must provide so many hours of service. And I think that they come into the university already having experienced that in high school. And it's something that really engages them. And we're trying to transform that into how are you learning within this. You know, not simply putting in the hours. We just, 2 weekends ago, we had the spring cleanup. We had 555 students going to clean up in the Hill and on the south side. And engage with 130 members from the Hill District in the south side. So, I mean, these were big numbers. And we put them in small groups and we partner them. You go to this church in the Hill District. You go to that group, community service. Well, there was a dance that night, and some of the young ladies from one of the sororities wanted to go get their hair done and do makeup stuff, and they blew it off. Well, you know, there are going to be significant consequences for that, you know, and I think that they're expecting it. But you know, we can engage them if that's the way that they're gonna, you know, approach the world. Then it's a common language that we have. You know, as I say, they're mystery. What they will become is yet to be determined. And the labels give insight, but they don't really describe the encounter. They're much greater than, you know, what might be recorded on a survey.
So, in my experience, right, Pitt will very often sort of mirror just general population, and that's good. But when I go up to CMU, computer geeks and robotic gurus and all of that, just I love them. They talk about their largest single self-identifying religious group is what we call the AHA group. Atheist, humanist, agnostics. It's out there. And folks are proud of it. And that, again, so my take is, in those situations, I am, I might be pastor to some, I'm chaplain to all. So I go out and I sit down in places, public places, on all the campuses, but I put a little sign up. It says, the theologian is in. Go ahead, ask me anything. And they might be atheist, or they might be agnostic, whatever. But I have had a number of people just sort of plop down in front of me and ask me a question. So in a sense, maybe we have to be very zen about it. We have to like reach out by not reaching out. You know, sit down, let them come to you. Just make yourself. Make it known that you're available, right? So, sitting in a coffee shop, doing some work, had my sign up, guy plops down in front of me and he goes, what is the nature of the moral life and what is its source? Okay, hi, I'm Brian. Let's have a conversation, right? So we start having this conversation and we talk about ethics and stuff and all this other stuff and it's very interesting. And he says, well, what about forgiveness? It doesn't seem like it changes anything because his notion of forgiveness is just saying I'm sorry and letting it go and talk about that and the notion of forgiveness being transformative. And finally, in that moment, he goes, how do I forgive myself? And I went, ha ha. And immediately everything switched because it wasn't just this conversation about, but this was a deep seated, and all that other stuff was just to see, I think, can I trust you? Can I really talk about this? And in a sense, at that moment, the coffee shop went from the coffee shop into a confessional, and we had these moments of connection and conversation. And that conversation went on like 45 minutes, and it was deeply meaningful. And he thanked me for being there, even though he didn't have any major connection. So one of the things I think is that notion of being able to see others, just out, forget the labels. We want to talk about spiritual concerns or needs of conscience. Guess what? They're human beings. They have all the spiritual concerns and needs of human beings. You know, they need notions of connection and relationship and love and trust and faith. So, and it's real, whether they want to acknowledge it or not.
A comment about aha, just the aha moment. It's interesting that you all want that aspect of being agnostic. And just the fact they identify themselves with any of those suggests that they are a little more involved than I was as a college student, that they are even it is engaged in questioning and challenge. The fact that you approach them, we society approach them as inclusive and loving, regardless and not judgmental, allows them to come to the
much contact with, yeah, I'm sorry.
No, you for them.
Much contact with international students, and how does that go?
For this year, the pianist at my worship service has been a student, like, right off the boat from China, who's not a Christian. And he comes and he plays music for us every Sunday. And you know, I broached after a good semester and a half, I went, okay, let me just ask, are you interested? And, you know, in those situations, there become dynamics that are involved with things like family. Like, so his grandmother back in China is Christian, and she goes to church. Now that I remember this is how I said it, she goes to church. He didn't say she was a Christian, but she goes to church. But his parents are not Christian. They don't go to church. And so he felt like he could come, but he didn't want to talk about baptism or anything along those lines. And I'm like, okay, you're welcome to be here. But he sits there and he prays with us, and he's part of it. And, you know, okay. So some are very open to it, and some, you know. So it's a very interesting place to be with international students. That's all I mean.
We have a rather large ministry at Penn State, Maine, and I often sit and talk to our director of that ministry. And one of the things that was an aha for me early on in our conversations was a big part of their ministry to these students. Didn't feel like a spiritual ministry, but was to help them acclimate to the United States, help them find the you know, learn the bus system and to be where things are and how the town's laid out and how do you navigate life in America. And so that's how he would begin a relationship with many of the international students. He'd say, Cliff, it's a totally different type of ministry than a traditional, you know, campus ministry. But not only that, being willing, you know, another thing that's really near to all of our hearts is, you know, cross-cultural ministries. Our campuses are becoming the most diverse places in our nation. And so being not only just being respectful of their culture, but willing, you know, they're coming to our culture, helping them understand our culture, but let's also get in their world and understand their culture. And if that happens to be Christian, let's incorporate that into what we are doing as so that they're part of the church, the universal church in our kids.
And with us, you know, we have, as a university, there is certainly a very structured outreach. you know, we have a number of students from Saudi Arabia and Muslim. And for years, we have had the Muslim prayer room above the sanctuary of the church. As Spiritans, we're a missionary community, so attention to these matters of welcome to us are extremely important. When we built a new campus ministry center down in the dorms, we built within it two Muslim prayer rooms, one for men, one for women, and an ecumenical prayer room. The ecumenical prayer room, unfortunately, is probably the best hiding place on campus. You know, it's just the way it is. We have kind of like a treasure hunt, go find it, you know, and invite kids to go. In terms of participation in matters of the broad outreach, it's not as good as I would like it to be. You know, we do mission trips, and very few of the international students go. They tend to stay back, and I think it's even though they can't go home. So after this spring break trip, now I'm in communication with a couple of other groups to see why it is that they're not participating. You know, we don't ask anything. Everybody can go on these service trips, but we may have to make them make another one strictly local for athletes and international students.
Is that way families could be involved with students in campuses like that that are from other countries?
Yeah, when I was, I pastored a church in Cambridge Springs, Allegheny College was in Meadville, Edinburgh College was in Edinburgh, of course. One of the families in our church is just flew open the doors to their home, to their international students, and actually had them over, cooked meals, had a fellowship right in their home. And I think that's why, you know, talking to your local campus ministers is vital, because they were deeply involved in international students in particular.
I'm hearing that, and I agree, great vehicles to include young people are leadership and service. But I'm also hearing and reading and stuff that the gaps for this age group are catechetical foundations, as you said. And I didn't hear anybody say it, but like spiritual development, establishment of the relationship with God and with the Christian community in general. In my mind, I can't comprehend how to do that. Are there programming ways to go about? I hear you talk pastoral care on a one-to-one, but that, you know, are there structures that you can develop? Basically that.
So one of the, I just got a grant to, the title of my grant was Campus Ministry as Outpost for Christian Spiritual Formation. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we're seeing is that we don't need to come up with new programs because ancient practices are reemerging, and they're so old they're new again, right? So the daily offices, the prayer offices become they are reemerging as something that are very valuable for young adults. They're finding.
So you're consciously putting those kinds of practices
right,
making them available.
So prayer of various ways. I'm finding that we talk about prayer, but we don't usually invite young adults into prayer very often. So mining, for me, the deep Christian tradition of prayer of many forms, prayer offices, contemplative prayer, become really helpful, right?
You offer places and times for that.
Absolutely. And in fact, I'm actually also then, just because it's we're dealing with young adults, we're developing a prayer app. So that not only do you have the prayer stuff in front of you, but that you can also connect with friends and you can see what your friends are praying for, and it's a way
nice
to sort of pray together without being together. And so hopefully it'll be out within a year. So so we have, you know, there are ways to use that. And we have, you know, we do every Sunday night in Hines Chapel there on the fifth campus, we have a ministry of Compline. And so this is interesting because it's an intergenerational choir that gathers, and they do choral Compline. And we are seeing more young adults in the choir itself and more young adults in the pews on Sunday night. Which?
What did you say is the ministry of?
A complement? A complement is.
Complement. Okay.
Yeah, the prayer at the close of the day.
Comfort, I didn't get it.
Sorry. Complement.
Complement, okay.
Swallow my words. Sorry. But there are those things that I think those practices are reemerging. We're seeing non-denominational churches return to imposition of ashes on Ash Wednesday. I mean, something is there, a return to sort of God as holy other that is
that's
missing.
That's been my sense, and that's why I wasn't sure how we can establish structures.
We don't have to establish them. They've been around. We have to just pull them out, dust them off, and reuse them. And I think.
And what about catechetical development? I mean, they're already so busy learning with school. What do you do with that?
For us, it's always about when we gather. We have time to. We have a midweek meal every once a week. It's Thursday nights. It's been this semester. Afterwards, we have what we call God Talk. And we lay it out. And so I've stopped calling it Bible study because that's negative. But they have questions, and we wrestle with it. Sometimes we pull out scripture. Sometimes we pull out theological works. This semester, for them, they wanted to talk about social statements from our ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. So we talked about those. And so there was a question of how we live and through that scriptural passage. So I'm sorry, I've talked too much.
Yeah, very well.
Sorry.
Could the other two of you respond to
that?
My question? Like, how do you structure or deal with catechetical development and spirituality?
Yeah, well, I work in the context of the local church to that end, and I'm a volunteer in that capacity. And coming from a very evangelical side of things, we incorporate pretty much everything that we've talked about here, working with the local campuses for students that are looking for a place. We incorporate them into the life of the church for the intergenerational. And when you mentioned the choir, we see our college students in our local choir, in the choir here. But we also have two times set a week, Sunday morning. And once again, we don't call it Bible study either. It's an open place for anybody, agnostic, atheist, anybody that can come. We do that Sunday morning for an hour between worship services and also a weeknight that the students, we incorporate student leadership into that as well. And so the students are very much, one of the requirements, as you will, is that they're keeping the pulse of their peers and they're advising us and we're advising them. And so we're finding out where they are in life. So, recently we just, on Monday nights from 8 to 10, time of fellowship, time of eating together, but also hour and a half conversation for a period of weeks on the Book of Romans. Pulling in various perspectives of various denominations and so forth. So trying to weave together a deeper biblical understanding with spiritual formation. Pulling in all the elements of campus ministry, developing leaders. I don't know if that completely answers your question, but that's kind of what we're doing on our end of things.
In our situation, kind of the catechetical, they have these things. It's a very shallow, many times, understanding, and they're looking for the answer without really delving into the question, into the reality. It's with Google and these things. I mean, they can get an answer, but I don't think that they have the understanding. So with practice, the students are attracted to the old. They want adoration, they want this, and they want that, and all these things are good. And so you invite them. But I bring them in and I say, that's a really good idea. Do you know what it is? No. Get the book. take the book and we begin to deconstruct. It says, you know, you can sing Tantum Ergo, something in Latin, or another Eucharistic song. Do you know Tantum Ergo? No, Father. Do you know another song? Yeah, we like this one. Put it in. And then you go through, and then you get all of these other options. And, you know, the offer, we'll do the part for the priest, but then we step back, you know, and we're not going to come back in until you need that type of assistance. We have a vocation discernment group, and we try to create community, you know, wherever we go. And we find that matters of retention and students not flourishing is when they're disconnected. You know, once you begin to have and feel connected, students are able to flourish much more often than when disconnected. So, you know, we're not in it for the long haul. We have a piece of it. So I think we try to introduce those things that are gonna bring the most meaning. But they have to be the ones to consume. And it has to be their questions. But when given the opportunity to take leadership, they're wonderful.
Could you comment on the impact of social media, texting, all of that which goes on in terms of the ability of students these days to connect with one another and to connect with adults? I worked with high school students about 14 years ago, and then 10 years later, I started working with them again, and it was like working with absolutely two different entities of persons, because they were so isolated from one another and so used to texting and being on their phones and instant gratification in terms of information, that kind of this interconnectedness in this relationship, which I think the gospel has to offer, it was very difficult to break down that. So, comment?
All I know is my 17-year-old daughter is going to be a senior in high school, is more connected to people she doesn't know than anyone I've ever met.
Yeah,
she was more connected to people in Pittsburgh when we moved here 3 years ago than I could ever imagine. So it is. I want to say this because they love technology, but it's not their end all be all. That's my perspective. And that is shown by them delving into that which is ancient. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember one of the church planters of the denomination I was part of came up with this great thought of an iPad church, and one of my college students said to him, "Dude, you don't get it. It's not about technology, it's about Jesus." And when he got kind of upset about it because he thought he had this big idea. He was trying to take pride. To get the faith to the technology, and not that it doesn't have an impact on how they live. I don't know what you guys see, but that virtual relationship, I think what I see, maybe you guys can speak to this, is while there is technology, there's a deep desire for community and for personal.
And I think that, you know, you take a look, people of our age, how many friends do you have? Friends. You define friends. They define it, you know, on a little ticker that, you know.
They define it as likes.
Yeah. It's, yeah, I mean, it's, these are different questions. And I think that, you know, the kids are comfortable with it. And, you know, and that's great, and that's the way they work with it. But I think they also desire the opportunity to be known and to know. You know, and they're going to open up the door a little bit, but I think that's the need, and whether it's being met. And so I think is church, you know, we could delve into all of that and perhaps not answer the real underlying need.
I'm a big fan of technology, and I've seen it used for really positive things, you know, and connection. But it is not a substitute. And I don't think young adults see it as a substitute for real connection either. They see it as a supplement, an addition to relationships, real life relationships, IRL relationships, because I think you're right. There's a deep desire to be known, and that's one way. And you know, they can do that. And the reality is too, with young adults, I mean, there's nobody uses the same thing. I in a sense, I have to be conversant in about half a dozen different things because everybody has an email address, but nobody checks it. Everybody has a Facebook thing, but none of the young adults use Facebook anymore. Nobody, the old people moved in, and you know, I'm on it, and so they're like, no, we're not going to be on it. So, you know, some are on Instagram, some are on Twitter, and some are, you know, and all right, so there we are. And but it's they culture where they find connection and meaning is where they end up, and it's. Whether it's good or whether it's bad, it's here, and it's not going anywhere. So there are a lot of people on it. And so best done, it helps augment and support the real relationships that they have. I think the same way. I've met people in real life that are I have great relationships with now, even though I've never seen them face-to-face.
Yeah, I became friends with somebody on Facebook
Thank you all very much.